From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a string of wins for Mitt Romney. The president slams a GOP budget and GOP ideology and steps toward intervention in Syria. Republicans and Democrats charging hidden agendas this week. Mitt Romney went straight at the president.
He wants us to reelect him so we can find out what he'll actually do. With all the challenges the nation faces, this is not the time for President Obama's hide-and-seek campaign.
President Obama called out Romney by name for the first time, said he was riding a Trojan horse of GOP budget plans.
It is a Trojan horse. Disguised as deficit reduction plans, it is really an attempt to impose a radical vision on our country. It is thinly veiled social Darwinism.
And intervention talk gathers around Syria. Special Envoy Kofi Annan wants a UN presence there to stop the violence.
What we would need on the ground is a small, nimble United Nations presence. It would need to be deployed quickly with a broad and flexible mandate.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with John Heilman of New York Magazine, Clarissa Ward of CBS News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. From New York City, John Heilman joins us, national affairs editor for New York Magazine, co-author with Mark Halperin of the 08 campaign chronicle Game Change, recently adapted into the big HBO movie on Sarah Palin and John McCain. John Heilman, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
Also with us from London is Clarissa Ward, covers the Middle East for CBS News. Her undercover reports from inside Syria brought her a George Foster Peabody Award this week. High accolades for great work. Clarissa Ward, congratulations and welcome back.
Thank you so much, Tom, and thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, our own Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, John, and Clarissa.
If we may, let's go straight to these jobs numbers. The administration and the country had been happy about having a couple hundred thousand plus every month on average since November. And here we come this morning, John, 120,000, far short of the 200,000 plus people were hoping for. Unemployment ticking down by a tenth to 8.2. But that's because we're told people are dropping out of the job market. This is not the kind of number anybody was looking for today, John. How do you interpret it?
I interpret it pessimistically, I'm afraid. And look, I mean, if you go around to private economic forecasters right now, you've heard for the last couple months a surprising degree of downcastness about what is ahead. And they've been downcast in the sense, surprising in the sense that the economy seems to have been picking up pace over the course of the last 6 months. But everyone you talk to says, look out in Q3 and Q4. This thing could flatten out again. Probably not a double dip on the recession front, but you could easily see a lot of the gains that we've made in the last 6 months in the sense of progress dissipate quickly as gas prices rise this summer, as they are almost inevitable to do. You keep hearing these kinds of pessimistic outlooks, and this might be the beginning of that coming to fruition, which is to say a bad picture for the economy and certainly, as you pointed out, a very, very discouraging political context for the Obama administration to try to get reelected in.
Clarissa Ward, if people are downcast, no small part of that grows out of Europe's ongoing troubles. Under your nose there in London, I mean, the U.S. was the bright and shining spot here compared to Europe in recent months. We've seen wobbles in Europe again just in the last week on debt and how it's going to be handled there, and now this out of the U.S. What's the interplay here, Clarissa?
Absolutely. Well, it's interesting hearing those figures because certainly from the context of the European newspapers, the U.S. has definitely been viewed rather optimistically and seen as doing quite well, at least in comparison to Europe, which, of course, on the back of last week's Spanish unemployment figures, which are just mind-boggling at this stage.
What were they, like 20% plus more?
Yeah, 20%, but amongst younger Spaniards, I believe under 25, it's almost like 50%.
Wow.
And forgive me if I have that statistic incorrect.
That's kind of a meltdown
it's extremely, extremely high, extremely frustrating for young Spaniards. And another think tank today in Great Britain saying that the Great Britain will likely avoid a double dip recession by 0.1%. So, I mean, at what point, I mean, how does one celebrate avoiding a double dip recession when one is only avoiding it by 0.1%?
By the skin of Europe's teeth, and only that if they're lucky. I mean, Jack Beatty, Ben Bernanke has been signaling, as John says, Q3, Q4 could be rougher this year. But here it is, right in everybody's lap, and it's only April now, Jack? The Fed could kick back into action. It's been unclear, and the markets have reflected this week, whether they would keep doing their huge bond purchases. Maybe this gets Bernanke back in gear, Jack.
Maybe so. He's been looking for the elusive growth. He spoke last week, I believe, about the discrepancy between the seeming good numbers on jobs and the lack of good numbers on growth. And this month, it looks as if the two have coincided more. The numbers coming down to match the really parlous growth. And, you know, John raised the political question. When you look at it, only one president since the war, Ronald Reagan, has been reelected with a jobless rate above 6%. He won in 84 with 7.2% in the month of the election. But as Bloomberg points out, that's after the rate had fallen almost 3 percentage points in the previous 18 months. That is to say, it was on the crest of a very energetic trend. The president, Mr. President Obama, is not going to have anything like that kind of good news.
Let's pull this right into national politics. That's where it is headed. That's where it lives. Of course, three big wins for Mitt Romney this week. But still, he's got that competition in the Republican Party. John, I want to ask you about this. Here's Rick Santorum on Tuesday. People had wondered if he might step aside now, but here he was back in Pennsylvania, his home state, following losses in Wisconsin, Maryland, and Washington, D.C. And here was the word from Santorum.
We have now reached the point where it's halftime. Half the delegates in this process have been selected. And who's ready to charge out of the locker room in Pennsylvania for a strong second half?
Yeah, charge out of the locker room. Is anybody ready to charge out for a strong second half, John, in the GOP primaries?
No, nobody. Not even Rick Santorum, I don't believe, Tom. Look, I mean, he faces a very difficult choice right now. There is no way that he can win the Republican nomination at this point. It's almost mathematically impossible. Not quite, but he would need to win 75% of the remaining delegates over the course of the rest of the nomination process. He's not going to do that. And so the delicate and difficult choice he faces is what to do about the Pennsylvania primary. We have 3 weeks from now, mm-hmm. a little less than 3 weeks from now. We have a bunch of primaries coming up, a kind of mini Super Tuesday. Mitt Romney will win all of them, except possibly Pennsylvania, which has now become very close. Pennsylvania is Rick Santorum's home state. Mitt Romney has now pulled ahead in the polling there. I've been mm-hmm. predicting for several weeks that Romney could win Pennsylvania. The choice for Santorum that I described as difficult is, does he try to stay on and fight and win just that one state, a state that is his home state, and so therefore he should win? And he could then argue, well, I have some momentum because Pennsylvania is a big state. I can now go on and fight in May in a bunch of southern states that are better suited to him demographically speaking. But the risk for him is losing his home state, which would not only drive him out of the race, for sure, he has said it is a must-win state for him, but it would also create a horrible, horrible overhang for him in his political future. He already faces a lot of doubts. There's already a story about the fact that he lost his home state in his Senate re-election in 2006 by 18 points. Mm-hmm. If he loses his home state against Mitt Romney, that will dog him into his future. If he wants to run again in 2016, if he wants to run in 2020, it'd be a horrible embarrassment. And so I think that there's a very good chance that over the course of the next week or so, when Rick Santorum realizes that Mitt Romney will do everything he can to kill him in Pennsylvania, spend a lot of money, and reduce his chances and his prospects to rubble, I think there's a pretty good chance Rick Santorum's going to drop out long before Pennsylvania.
Santorum's candidacy hanging out over the edge this week, Mitt Romney on a roll. President Obama saw that, and even before the voting was wrapped up earlier this week, he was slamming the GOP. He took aim at the GOP budget from Paul Ryan out of Wisconsin and more, wrapped it around Mitt Romney's neck, and then had this to say about Trojan horses and thinly veiled social Darwinism.
It is antithetical to our entire history as a land of opportunity and upward mobility for everybody who's willing to work for it. A place where prosperity doesn't trickle down from the top, but grows outward from the heart of the middle class. And by gutting the very things we need to grow an economy that's built to last. Education and training, research and development, our infrastructure, it is a prescription for decline.
Radical Republicans said the president gutting the future, a prescription for decline. Mitt Romney charged right back at the president the next day, same venue. This is Wednesday before some press in Washington, saying the president's ideology is at odds with the American dream.
If we become one of those societies that attacks success, then outcome is certain. There will be less success. That's not who we are. The promise of America has always been that if you worked hard and took some risks, that there was the opportunity to build a better life for your family and for the next generation. I'm offering a clear choice and a different path. And unlike the president, I have a record that I'm proud to run on.
John Heilman, if this is the big choice that's going to be set on the table before the American people, who looks to you at this point as though they have the stronger case in these two sort of, you know, here's my case moments?
Wow. Well, Tom, I think that they both are going to prosecute these cases very vigorously. I think it's going to be a very clear choice between the two sides. The Obama campaign and the president are going to wrap Paul Ryan's budget around Mitt Romney's neck in the same way that Bill Clinton wrapped Newt Gingrich's plans around Bob Dole's neck back in 1996. Joe Biden was on TV the other day and he said, you know, it's great. Republicans are not hiding the ball. Republicans are telling us what they want to do. Mm-hmm. Look at the Ryan budget. They're going to try to make this in a very clear choice kind of an election. Romney's going to have the same kind of an argument about the president. And I think it's going to be a very close election, and to go back to our first topic, so much matters in terms of what the economic context is. If the trajectory is positive, Barack Obama's going to have the better case, but if we're trending down, Mitt Romney's going to be in a much better position and quite conceivably could win.
John Heilman, Clarissa Ward, Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. Listeners, what do you think? Is it Romney's nomination? Is Obama right? Do we have a radical Republican Party? And what about those job numbers? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Romney on a roll, the president on the attack, intervention talk rising on Syria, and bad job creation numbers out today. Clarissa Ward joins us, correspondent for CBS News. She joins us from London. Won a Peabody Award this week for her work in Syria. We'll look at the situation there. It's big this week. John Heilman is with us from New York Magazine, national affairs editor there, co-author of Game Change. You may have seen the HBO movie. His reporting with Mark Halperin was behind it. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Clarissa, we've got a lot to look at here stateside, but there's been so much talk about Syria this week, and I wish you would help us untangle it a little bit. We heard that Kofi Annan at the top of the hour there talking about getting a small, nimble force in there. Our listeners are paying close attention. Greg writes to us online, Syria needs a small and nimble UN force. How about we send them a flock of unicorns as well? The latter is no more improbable than the former. Here was Hillary Clinton in Istanbul in Turkey on Sunday at the Friends of Syria conference, pledging aid and support to Syrian rebels. Clarissa, we want your interpretation. Let's listen here.
The United States is also going beyond humanitarian aid and providing support to the civilian opposition, including communications equipment that will help activists organize, evade attacks by the regime, and connect to the outside world.
Clarissa Ward, there's the U.S. Secretary of State. A lot of people meeting there, $100 million or more pledged to, among other things, putting Syrian rebels on a payroll by outside nations and U.S. with communications equipment there. What path are the world's feet on here? Are we moving toward an intervention? Is this the intervention, Clarissa?
Well, I must say I was actually quite surprised. I was at the Friends of Syria
conference. You interviewed Secretary Clinton there.
I did. Mm-hmm. I did indeed. And I was quite surprised by the amount of action that we've seen from within the international community. I think there is a growing sense of frustration with the diplomatic process. I think many people attending the conference, many delegates, were really discouraged by the amount of violence that is still ongoing in Syria, even after President Bashar al-Assad claims to have accepted Kofi Annan's six-point peace plan.
Even right now, today as we speak, we're hearing more reports.
Oh, absolutely. There's been shelling in Homs. There's been shelling in outside Damascus. There are reports from some doctors inside the country of possible chemical weapons attacks. So certainly there's no sense. The government appears to be intent on using every last minute it has to kill as much or quash the rebellion to the best of its ability before it has to adhere to the Tuesday morning deadline of pulling its troops and tanks from civilians.
We're talking 3-4 days from now, Tuesday that's passed or Tuesday ahead?
Tuesday ahead. The official deadline is Tuesday ahead. Tanks and troops have to be pulled out of towns and villages and cities. And then by Thursday morning, 6 a.m., all violence has to have stopped. Complete ceasefire.
Or what?
I think everyone's... Well, this is the problem. And this is what the question I put to Secretary Clinton. She had talked about the need to have some kind of a deadline or a timeline, and that Bashar al-Assad should not be allowed to use this UN peace plan as a tactic to stall for time. But when I said to her, well, how do you enforce that deadline? There wasn't really a clear sense of what the answer would be. You know, the best idea that she gave me was that, well, then we could go back to the Security Council, and Russia and China at this stage having, you know, having agreed to the Annan plan and having told Syria that it should adhere to the plan. Mm. Well, if Syria doesn't adhere to the plan, then we'll have more leverage getting Syria, getting China and Russia on board to progress things further in terms of putting more pressure
well,
on.
Maybe. I mean, here's the sound of that ultimatum kind of talk, again, from the Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who Clarissa Ward was talking with this week in Istanbul.
So today, we called for an immediate end to the killing in Syria, and we urged the Joint Special Envoy, Kofi Annan, to set a timetable for next steps. The world will not waver. Assad must go, and the Syrian people must be free to choose their own path forward.
Assad must go. World won't waver. So with $100 million on the table and rebel payroll being met here by outside nations, including Middle Eastern nations, I mean, are we already, and the U.S. providing communications equipment, that can mean all kinds of things, are we already in an intervention in Syria? Are we in the middle of a civil war there?
Well, I think at this stage it's fair to categorize what's going on inside Syria as a form of civil war, absolutely. I think that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states, with this $100 million plan to put the rebels on the payroll, so to speak, have actually been quite sort of cunning in how they've done that. They're trying to avoid, although it's definitely the most direct form of intervention that we've seen, and while there's no doubts that that money is going to be used to buy guns rather than sort of create pensions for these rebel fighters. They are quite careful not to outwardly still be seen as directly arming the rebels. I mean, the interesting thing I think about this $100 million as well is, okay, well, they'll be wanting to buy a lot of guns with that, but there still hasn't been any real sense of how to get those guns into the country. And it's not just Kalashnikovs that these rebel fighters need at this stage. They need proper long-range, you know, anti-tank and anti-aircraft weaponry.
Do you believe, is there any way with a ceasefire, if it comes on next week, can this end that way after all the bloodshed and the amazing depth of bitterness that we see here?
It's very hard for me to wrap my head around the idea that this could all be nicely resolved in the next few weeks, partially because for the opposition, the crucial thing about Annan's plan that they disagree so vehemently with is that it still creates a role for Bashar al-Assad. He's essentially part of the solution, and it's all about sort of establishing political reform and some kind of reconciliation within a government that gives them more of a voice. Well, for these opposition activists, the point of no return was passed quite a long time ago, and they have no interest really in negotiating with Bashar al-Assad in the hopes of creating some kind of a unity government. So I think both sides have their own agenda about how they see this playing out in the long run in their favor, and neither of those agendas really are conducive to peace in the near future.
And finally on this one, is Kofi Annan dreaming when he imagines a light mobile UN force running around Syria, stopping Assad's forces every time they try to attack a different city?
Well, exactly. I mean, I think that's the question. And certainly if one looks at the history of these peacekeeping forces in Bosnia and Congo, they've been deeply problematic wherever they've been, either because of the very strong limitations placed on their role, but also because of the sort of scandals that have also seemed to follow them every country they go to. So
we've got a lot on the table here domestically and abroad. Let's go to our listeners. We've got John Heilman here from New York Magazine, Clarissa Ward from CBS, and our own Jack Beatty. Mark is calling. Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I watched the president's speech earlier this week, and it was a direct indictment of trickle-down economics, which is really Reaganomics, and what George Herbert Walker Bush referred to as voodoo economics when he was running against Reagan in 1980. The president made the point that we've tried it for three decades, and the result was that you had this huge increase in income disparity where the rich get richer and everybody else either stays the same or falls behind. George W. Bush's job growth record was the worst of any presidential administration since records have been kept. Now, my question is for your panel, do you think it would have helped if he had given this speech in February 2009, right after he took office, and pointed out that this is the reason we got into this mess? Or do you think that it would have been politically futile? And my second question is, why does the media, present program excluded, but why do the big networks not do the kind of documentaries they used to do, like Harvest of Shame, things like that, to try to answer the fundamental questions that the country faces?
What's actually working here? And Mark, we've got it. Let me put those both on the table, and John, I'll come first to you with this big choice. And Mark wants to know if this is so true what the president said this week. It sounds like Mark believes it is. Why didn't he roll this out 4 years ago? And does it work politically this time? The big indictment.
Well, I think that's a very, very different time context, and there's no question that President Obama came into office at a time when the country was in a state of economic emergency and where the president still had hopes at that point of being able to work in a bipartisan way with some Republicans to try to fix the problems that ailed the economy at that moment, save the financial system, help the auto industry, all the things that he did to mm-hmm. one degree or another. I think launching your presidency with a scathing indictment of the other party when you want to try to forge some kind of cooperation would be a pretty foolish thing to do politically. Now, you could say the president was naive in thinking that Republicans would ever work with him, and that would be a fair point to make, as it turned out. But I think the president's thinking at that point was that there was still some chance he could work with Republicans, didn't want to start out by smacking them upside the head, having just won election a couple months earlier.
Yep.
It is now an election season, and so for the president to try to draw bright lines makes a lot more sense. He's also much more frustrated with the Republican Party. He wants to win. It's a totally different context. And I will say that what I thought was strong about the speech, and the caller made the first of these points, which is that he made the indictment that the Republican Ryan budget has a direct corollary and lineage going back as far as Reaganomics, and that it has not worked, first of all. He also said, secondly, that there is a long tradition in our politics on the Republican side as well as the Democratic side of doing investments in infrastructure and human capital, and that is what works, and what Republicans going back as far as Eisenhower and I think as far back as Lincoln, he was arguing, have been in favor of. And the third thing was, in terms of the clear choice, was to say, we have a deficit problem, we have a debt problem. The question is not whether we have that problem. The question is who is going to sacrifice and how broadly the sacrifice is going to be spread to try to solve it. And I think on those three points, that is what the choice that they are trying to frame is going to be based on. You're going to hear that three-part critique of Republicans and a three-part framing of the choice for the next 6 months.
Deficit problem, but also, and we see it again today, a huge jobs problem right in front of us. Jack Beatty, what do you think about the narrative that's shaping up here of the country facing in this presidential election, 2012, this kind of epical choice of what, who are we? What kind of country are we going to be? You heard the way the president put it. You heard Mitt Romney there. I mean, David Brooks comes out in the New York Times today and says this is the president putting on his Keith Olbermann mask, resorts to hoary, brain-dead cliches, cast himself as the fiscal moderate, then unleashes, Brooks writes, every 1980s liberal cliche in the book. He says Obama's exaggerating the differences between his budget and the Ryan budget. So what is it? Do we have two really different views here of how to go forward? How does that play out as a narrative politically in this campaign, Jack? Are we going to decide in 2012, the country we're going to be for the first part of this century?
Well, I think we will. David Brooks's paper, the New York Times, calls this a cruel budget. Is it?
Well, Paul Ryan's budget, you're saying.
Paul Ryan's, yeah. 62% of the 3-point-something trillion in cuts would come from low-income programs. That sounds, if not cruel, tough. And on the other side, the social Darwinist side, what does it do for the rich? Well, people, again, according to the Brookings Tax Policy Center, people earning more than $1 million a year would receive $265,000 apiece in new tax cuts. That's on top of the $129,000 they'd get from the Ryan budget's extension of Bush's tax cuts. So it looks like at least you can make an arguable case. This is social Darwinism. Tough on the poor and good to the rich. What about the middle class? Well, again, according to the Brookings, they only get 1.9% of these tax cuts. it doesn't look like it's very good for them. And, you know, behind this is a philosophy, and Paul Ryan has given it to his credit. He's been candid at the American Enterprise Institute. He says that the country is at an insidious moral tipping point and that President Obama is accelerating it, and that dependency, he says, is lulling able-bodied people into lives of complacency, which is draining them of their will and incentive to make a go in life, make a go of it in life. So he, the idea is to restore some incentive to the dependent in America, and presumably that means people receiving Medicare, Medicaid, and aid to the poor. And what's striking about this, when you look at the polls, how do Republican voters feel about these things? Well, a March YouGov poll found that only 17% of Republican primary voters wanted cuts in scientific research. Only 20% wanted cuts in Medicare. Only a third wanted cuts in Medicaid. Only 36% want aid to the poor cut. And yet, the Ryan budget would cut all of these programs, which even Republican base voters, at least according to this poll, don't want.
But I suppose if you asked, do you want the deficit cut, people definitely in that cohort would say yes to that. And that's not easy to do. Clarissa, I want to bring this to you, but let's go to Iowa first. Spencer, Iowa. Austin, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks a lot for all your hard work and everyone else at NPR. And thanks to your guests. I think they've been doing a great job so far.
Great.
I just wanted to make the comment that I graduated from the University of Iowa with a degree in economics in May, and I wanted to get into renewable energy, so I'm now taking classes at Iowa Lakes Community College in the wind turbine technology program.
Okay.
I was wondering if I feel like the Republican Party is pretty much blocking President Obama's objectives. He stated in the State of Union address that he wanted all above strategy, which includes wind. And right now, the production tax credit has been passed to be extended, which has done great things for the wind industry in the last couple of years. And wind is very close to being able to stand on its own.
Yeah.
Now, that policy has been shut down, and I just feel like it's almost the Republicans' initiative right now to block programs like this that will save jobs. 37,000 jobs are at stake right now in manufacturing plants across the country, especially Iowa, that have done well in the time of, you know, these last few years.
Around wind.
Other manufacturing facilities have been doing terrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's been projected that the passage of the PTC, the production tax credit for wind and other renewables, will add hundreds of thousands of jobs in the next 5 years.
Austin, we've got it. We've got your particular perspective there, your complaint, in your case you're making on the GOP, your hopes for this particular wind initiative with some government support. Clarissa, all right. Let's take that and our previous caller's question. The previous caller says, look, big media, get in there and sort this out. You know, do the documentaries and bring us the answer about what's working and what's not. Don't leave us in a fog. Who's going to sort this out, Clarissa? Will it be the news media sort of, you know, getting the facts of the consequences of this or that policy? Will it be American voters at the polls? What do you see coming, Clarissa?
Well, I would say two things. First of all, not to sound like I'm shilling for CBS News here, but I really do believe that that CBS has a very strong commitment to getting into the nitty-gritty of the very issues that we're discussing and trying to illuminate them for viewers. And obviously, you know, under the helm of 60 Minutes and Scott Pelley and now Charlie Rose as well, I do believe that CBS has a particularly strong commitment to doing the kind of journalism you referred to, Harvest of Shane, etc. Secondly, just coming to the point about wind energy and just, you know, I spent the last three years in China. And it's so very interesting for me to listen to the sort of continuous bipartisan debate going on inside the U.S. and coming at it from a perspective, the Chinese see America now as essentially not even really a firm opponent. They believe so strongly now that between America's debt, between the sort of political infighting that seems to be paralyzing the American system, that America is now in a very, very precarious position. So I just thought it was kind of interesting touching on that when you look how China is plowing ahead in terms of renewable
energy. We've got a break right here, Clarissa. It's a good point. Hold it right there. We're talking about the week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, dozens of twisters, tornadoes hit Texas, leveling homes and tossing trucks. In Lancaster, Texas, it brought to mind Dorothy and her little dog, Toto.
It was scary. It was so scary. It reminded you of the Wizard of Oz when the tornado hit and everything kept going around and around.
New tape out of Greg Williams, defensive coordinator for the New Orleans Saints, now suspended, encouraging his players to aim to injure specific body parts on specific players. In this case, running back Frank Gore and tight end Vernon Davis of the San Francisco 49ers. Listen closely.
We need to decide on how many times we can beat Frank Gore's head. We need to decide how many times we can bull rush and we can put Vernon Davis's ankles over the pile.
And Jim Marshall, creator of rock and roll icon the Marshall Amplifier, died this week at 88. His guitar amps and their big sound were used by many of the most popular guitarists in history, including Jimi Hendrix, here at Woodstock 1969. Looking at a week in the news, Romney on a roll, the president on the attack, intervention talk rises on Syria, bad jobs numbers. Clarissa Ward is with us from CBS. She's in London, covers the Middle East. A good week for her. Big accolades, a Peabody Prize for her reporting out of Syria. John Heilman's with us from New York Magazine, terrific national affairs editor there, co-author of Game Change, and our own Jack Beatty's here. Lots of listeners leaning in here. Chris in Jewett City, Connecticut. Chris, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
One of your guests cited the American people don't want this cut, they don't want that cut, and they don't want their taxes raised. I don't know where we think the money's going to come from, but it really doesn't matter who the president of the United States is. Mitt Romney and Barack Obama are basically pretty much centrists, and they keep moving to get their nominations. Barack Obama did it 4 years ago, and Mr. Romney's doing it now. It's the Congress and the Senate we have to worry about. We got to get some people in there that will actually sit down and, you know, saying, hey, there's no such thing as a free lunch. We got to straighten this out. It's the Congress we got to worry about. The president's really can't do anything without the Congress.
Hey, Chris, we got it. You see two centrists fighting for the presidency. They're describing themselves at opposite poles of the world. You want something else entirely, maybe. I mean, it's interesting. This week, the president's health care plan on the chopping block, essentially, at the Supreme Court. And this was an interesting moment of one branch talking to another when the president, quite controversially, ultimately, at a press conference on Monday, said that he was confident that his health care law would not be struck down by the Supreme Court, really kind of jabbing with the elbow here from the White House to the courtroom.
I just remind conservative commentators that 4 years, what we've heard is the biggest problem on the bench was judicial activism or a lack of judicial restraint, that an unelected group of people would somehow overturn a duly constituted and passed law. Well, there's a good example, and I'm pretty confident that this court will recognize that and not take that step.
It looks like a shoving match between the White House and the Supreme Court. John Heilman, there was all kinds of pushback to the president here. Conservatives saying, come on. The Supreme Court did all kinds of, activism toward the liberal wing of American life for years, and now you're unhappy when it goes the other way. And let's be reminded, there was not a single Republican vote here in Congress for this health care reform package. What about the president's remarks here? Justified or not, John?
Well, I think that tonally and in other ways, they went a little far in the sense that I think it's a little bit unseemly for the president, any president of any party, to be openly kind of critiquing the other branches of government in quite that way. And I don't...
Though the Supreme Court was not hesitant to do that of Congress in its argumentation here.
No, that's certainly true. But I just think, I think the president knows that he went a little far. That language of unelected judges, well, that's what judges are. Judges are unelected. The president's a constitutional lawyer. He knows He knows what that he knows about Marbury versus Madison. He knows that that is the job of the Supreme Court, which is to rule on the constitutionality of laws duly passed by Congress. Every time it, it makes a judgment of that kind, that's what it's doing. And there's nothing inappropriate about the Supreme Court overturning any law by Congress if it judges it unconstitutional. The president knows that. And I think when he used the language of these unelected judges, that's language that he borrows from the right, which criticizes liberal judges for being these unelected elitists in robes and et cetera, et cetera. I think the next day when the president spoke to the newspaper editors, he used the same – he tried to – he made the same point, which is to say that he thinks that this law is constitutional and he thinks it does fall well within precedent on the Commerce Clause going back many, many years without using quite that incendiary a tone. It looked to me like the president even knew that he had gone a little bit too far in those first remarks and he dialed them back considerably over the next day to make the same point substantively but not with quite the same kind of political edge.
Jack, what do you make of this? It looks like public shoving match in a way.
Yes, and perhaps a shot across the bow, warning the court that its legitimacy could become an issue in the presidential campaign. And the president is pandering there, or appealing, to put it neutrally, to public sentiment. Just in the last, 2 years, there's been a 15-point decline in public approval of the Supreme Court's decision. Of course, that's just the period of Citizens United. Three-quarters of people now believe that ideology and politics at least sometimes influences court decisions. And prior to the last week's hearing, a poll found that 75% thought that politics would influence the decision. So there is a climate out there of suspicion toward the court, and there could be a reversal. We've had a decade or more of conservative attacks on the court, and I think the president is indicating he's not going to be above reminding voters how important it is to elect the right president. If you want an active government, Democrats, if you want security, if you want health care, whatever it might be, you've got to think of voting in a Democratic president because that's the person that appoints the right Supreme Court justice.
The right, depending where you stand. Of course, Republicans got that message a long time ago and have acted vigorously on it. Let's go to Nashville, Tennessee, and Lucius. Lucius, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for taking my call, Tom, and it's really interesting you mentioned Supreme Court. If I'm correct, Tom, on yesterday you had a program concerning the Supreme Court making a ruling that if you have a broken taillight or if you speed over the limit about a mile or two or something of that nature that you would go to jail. Did I hear that program right? Because I wanted to call in, and I just wanted to get your wonderful panel's insight on that. Did the Supreme Court pass that law? And if they did, is there any way when a Supreme Court passes a law that it can be changed? Because I thought that was a little bit extreme to arrest someone for, you know, a little bitty, I guess, breaking the law.
Yeah, well, and then end up with a strip search in jail. Well, now let's clarify exactly there. Yes, they did rule on that this week. And the ruling was that whatever takes you to jail, be it ever so small an offense, jailers can... Once you're headed into jail, you can be subject to invasive strip search. And that is the ruling from the high court. Now, Justice Breyer, who was in the dissent, rolled out all kinds of examples of just how minor some of the offenses could be. And this was actually from the historical record not so long ago, where people have been brought in on these very tiny things and ended up in a strip search situation. I was kind of head up about that, but... You know, the reason was it goes to my sense. Hey, I'm not on the court, but my personal sense of the inviolability of the American citizen. You know, if our bodies themselves are that vulnerable to whatever the jailer thinks is right, I'm left wondering where that stands. John Howman, this was a decision that got a lot of attention here, but less than it might have if it weren't for all the healthcare stuff flying around. We had a hot discussion of it yesterday with legal minds, conservative and libertarian, it turns out, on either sides of this. But the court has come right into the middle of this question. It was different before 9/11. Most of the federal appeals courts were deciding the other way, and now they're saying, nope, you go to jail for whatever small offense, you're going to be open to invasive strip search, John.
Yes. And, you know, look, it tells you a lot about how conservative the court has become. It tells you a lot about how deferential the court has become to certain kinds of institutional prerogatives. That's what
jailers.
This case is about. Jailers, right? It basically said, look, that we can't get into the business of telling each individual jail what's required to keep the jail safe. And so we can't, the court doesn't want to try to make those kind of distinctions on a case-by-case basis. So we have to basically say that the people who run prisons are responsible for the safety of those prisons, and they should have wide latitude to keep keep their prisons safe.
Is that
even
a conservative opinion? I mean, that goes my inner conservative upset.
Yeah. Tom, yeah. I'm just saying, yeah. I'm saying conservative in the sense of deferential to a certain kind of institutional mm-hmm. authority.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
That's that. I personally am a very strong civil libertarian. I think that random drug testing is violative of illegal search and seizure. So I'm with you ideologically. I'm just trying to do the analysis of this is where the court is now. On certain kinds of institutional prerogatives, the court gives wide leeway. And again, prisons are one of them. I think if you're right, it's very much a post 9/11 kind of a decision. I find it personally very upsetting, but not that surprising, given the way that the court has ruled on similar kinds of issues mm-hmm. where institutional prerogatives around safety and especially around issues of anything that can be vaguely defined as national security, whether that's on the criminal side or on the national security side in terms of foreign policy, it has become very deferential to executive authority, very deferential to institutional authority of this kind. So I'm not surprised as much as I am kind of dismayed, just as you are.
Makes me think about liberty. I don't know. Maria, Iowa City, yes. You're on the air, Maria.
Hi, Tom. I think President Obama's comments were entirely appropriate. When you consider the strip search decision, which absolutely horrified the American Civil Liberties Union and myself, I'm sure others, and Citizens United, if you go back to 2000 and consider that the Supreme Court decided our election for us, I think the court has discredited itself. And I want Antonin Scalia, who went duck hunting with Dick Cheney, when he was considering a case involving Dick Cheney and his refusal to recuse himself on that and many other court decisions, as well as Clarence Thomas, whose wife is working actively against the health care law called Obamacare, I think that we need to be looking at which Supreme Court justices to impeach. And I would start with Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas.
Well, it's getting hot on the court front, and it will no doubt, it may well, I should say, be hotter as they come toward their actual decision on health care. Let's put that on the side for just a moment, because we're going to hear a lot more about the court in coming weeks and months, no doubt. I want to come back to Mitt Romney for a minute, and now that he seems to be wrapping up this front-runner status in a more convincing way, and now he's going to take his candidacy forward. This was a town hall meeting in Wisconsin on Monday. An audience member there began reading some quotes from the Book of Mormon, and questioned Mitt Romney about whether his Mormonism affected his views or would affect them on interracial marriage. Now, the sound quality is not great, but listen to how quickly Mitt Romney just shuts that door.
In the Mormon book, it says there were a black to stamp on all the children of Canaan.
I'm sorry, we're just not going to have a discussion about religion, in my view, but if you have a question, I'll be happy to answer your question.
I guess my question was, do you believe it's a sin for a white man to marry and appropriate with a black man?
No. Next question.
Let me just, the questioner says, is it a sin for a white man to marry and procreate with a black? Sort of with some reference, I don't know this, but to the Book of Mormon, and you hear Mitt Romney saying no. His answer is no. Next question. Jack, if Mitt Romney is now emerging front and center and he's headed for that nomination, is this the correct way? Is it a persuasive way for him to handle this issue? What do you think of that exchange and what it tells us?
Well, political consultants have been saying that Mr. Romney's problem is the people don't know him, and that if you get to the bottom of Mitt Romney, what you really find is strong religious faith that has informed almost everything he's done in his life, and yet he doesn't talk about it. Contrast Rick Santorum, and even contrast the president in some moods. And the thinking is, well, if he talked more about it, people would understand his ethical core. But he doesn't because of the, lamentable, negative views, at least among some, toward Mormonism. And this week, without any proof, Orrin Hatch, who was a Mormon running for re-election in Utah, came out mm-hmm. and said that the Obama campaign is going to use Mr. Romney's religion against him. That seems so unlikely. On the other hand, the president this week did sort of, I don't know if it's not a dog whistle to religion, but it's a dog whistle to there's something odd about Mitt Romney when he made a point about marvelous that, the president said that Mr. Romney called the Ryan Budget marvelous, pause, a word you don't hear very often. I just detected there a little gesture toward what a year ago, before he banned it, David Axelrod was calling the weird factor about Romney. Now, of course, you're fired in the Democratic camp if you say that. But I just hear a kind of venom beginning to creep in, or a satire, if you want to put it softer, toward Mr. Romney, who can't really, because of public sentiment, open up about what's really at his ethical core.
Venom and satire in American politics? You must be kidding, Jeff. We're shocked, shocked. Hey, Clarissa, we've got you, and we've got to ask you a different presidency entirely. In Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood reversing itself this week and saying it will put a candidate, and quite a prominent one, up to run for the presidency of Egypt. Are we headed, might we be, for an Islamic state in Egypt? What's happening there?
Well, I think undoubtedly we are headed for an Islamic state in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood already has a majority in parliament and the assembly, which is currently going about writing a new constitution. They had said that they would not be putting forward a candidate for the presidency, but now they are claiming that the military regime is not dealing appropriately with the economic crisis and that there are certain threats to the revolution. So they're putting their candidate forward. The candidate himself, he's been described as sort of conservative but pragmatic. But of course, the worry is for the West that the Egypt-Israel peace agreement, which is really considered absolutely crucial to regional stability, may somehow come into question if indeed he wins a big victory. Although looking at it from another mm-hmm. perspective, actually the U.S. has tacitly sort of welcomed the Muslim Brotherhood putting forward this candidate because other far more extremist, far more Salafist bending or leaning candidates had been running for the presidency. And as far as the U.S. is concerned, at least the Muslim Brotherhood candidate is a sort of a known commodity, if you will.
Known commodity in the Muslim Brotherhood. Watch this space as well, no doubt, and we will. John Hellman, we didn't even get to VP picks for Mitt Romney, and you've written. Give us a couple of top three names. What do you think, John?
Rob Portman, senator from Ohio, former head of the Office of Management and Budget. Very boring, but very much like Mitt Romney and a strong Ohio pick. There's going to be a big temptation for him to try to reach out to someone surprising, but the specter of Sarah Palin, I think, will keep him from picking some unknown person who might be more exciting but also more unpredictable.
We'll follow that space as well. John Hellman with New York Magazine. Great to have you. Thanks, John.
Thanks, Tom.
Clarissa Ward with CBS. Thanks, Clarissa. And Jack, thanks to you. Thanks all.
Thank you.
This is On Point.